script was written by Gene Lawhorn. This program was produced by Gene Lawhorn and Judy Berry and engineered by Judy Berry.
On April 15, 1920, in South Braintree, Massachusetts, four men execute a payroll robbery outside the Slater and Morrill Shoe Company. The two guards transporting the money, Alessandro Berardelli and Frederick Parmenter, were cold-bloodedly executed as the robbery was carried out. Just who committed this robbery and for what reason has been hotly debated since the arrest and conviction of two anarchists active in radical labor union and socialist activities, Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti. Today's program explores their lives, anarchist beliefs, and their frame-up for two murders they unquestionably did not commit.
Niccolo Fernando Sacco was born April 22, 1891, in Terra Maggiore, Italy. The son of prosperous peasants, he immigrated to the U.S. in April of 1908. Upon arriving in America, he secured work in construction as a water boy. Not liking the field of the unskilled laborer, Sacco paid for lessons to become a skilled tradesman as an edge trimmer in the shoemaking industry. After training, he got work in the Milford Shoe Company. In May of 1912, Sacco married Rosina Zambelli. A year later, they had a son named Dante. Because of Sacco's stature as a highly skilled, well-paid worker from a prosperous family, many who study his life may question his reasonings for being an anarchist. Paul Averick, in his book, Sacco and Vanzetti, The Anarchist Background, says that the conditions that Sacco saw in America turned him towards anarchism. Comparatively well off, though he was not blind to the suffering of others.
Sacco was greatly influenced by the writings and actions of the Industrial Workers of the World, also known as the IWW, or the Wobblies. He collected money to support Joseph Etter and Arturo Giovannetti, who were arrested on trumped-up murder charges during the Lawrence Bread and Roses strike of 1912.
Averick, in Sacco and Vanzetti, The Anarchist Background, describes Sacco as a man of few and simple beliefs. Capitalism is evil, government is slavery, war is crime against humanity, freedom is essential for human development. Anarchism, as he defined it, meant no government, no police, no judges, no bosses, no authority, autonomous groups of people. The people own everything, work in cooperation, distribution by need, equality, justice, comradeship, and love each other. The state, he believed, existed to protect the interests of private property, and history of all government had been the martyrdom of the proletariat. In 1913, Sacco spent many enlightening hours on the picket line of the Draper Shoe Company. Joseph Caldwell, one of the strike leaders, recalled that Sacco was not a great orator or even a fluent speaker, but he was a mighty good worker in detailed matters and never hesitated to do his share of appointed work. In December of 1916, Sacco was arrested for violating a ban on open-air meetings in the center of town. This was his only arrest until May 5th of 1920 for murder.
Bartolomeo Vanzetti was born June 11, 1888, in Villa Folletto, Italy, also of prosperous peasant stock. As a young man, Barto, as he was affectionately called, learned the skill of pastry making and confectioner in his father's cafe. In 1907, Barto's mother died after a lingering, painful battle with cancer. Her death affected him to the point of feeling suicidal. It was in this silent, morose frame of mind that Bartolomeo Vanzetti decided to immigrate to America. On June 9th of 1908, he departed Italy and arrived on Ellis Island on June 20th.
Vanzetti's first job in America was as a dishwasher, working 12 to 14 hours a day for $6 a week. Because of the long hours and very harsh working conditions of all unskilled workers of that era, Vanzetti would move from one industrial type of job to another. In a span of less than 10 years, he held jobs as a transient farm worker, construction, bricklayer, rock quarry, and cordage factory. For a short period of time, he found work as a skilled pastry chef's assistant. In this industry, Vanzetti would fall victim to a kickback scam whereby job sharks or employment agencies would kick back half of their receipts to the restaurant owners who would hire and fire in cycles, keeping an influx of workers coming and going.
Vanzetti's work experience, coupled with his insatiable appetite for reading, determined his radical socialist and anarchist philosophy.
Paul Averick in Sacco and Vanzetti, The Anarchist Background, says, "Of all the political groups, Vanzetti became convinced only the anarchists, through incessant mental work, had made a clean sweep of the false and oppressive teachings that were inculcated in us from our infancy. Only the anarchist, in contrast to the other radicals, favored the abolition of government, the chief source of tyranny and subjugation. Only the anarchist, moreover, envisaged a completely new social order, shorn of inequities and injustice." Averick continues that overthrowing the existing political and social order became the avowed object of Vanzetti's life. He favored a complete and radical change in the existing social order and was ready to use violence to achieve it.
Another experience which would solidify Vanzetti's anarchist philosophies was his participation in a strike at the Plymouth Cordage Company in January of 1916. Vanzetti played a leadership role, making speeches, collecting donations, and organizing marches. During the strike, the American Federation of Labor and the industrial workers of the world competed to organize the strikers. They refused to join either union. Vanzetti applauded the strikers' refusal to join either union. He perceived this as submitting to the authority of union bureaucrats. He said,
"Meaningful change could be achieved only by workers themselves through their own cooperative efforts."
A month later, the strike was settled for a general increase of a dollar. Vanzetti felt this settlement was a defeat and more than once found himself ejected from a speaker's platform for denouncing the offer.
According to Paul Averick, Italian anarchists fell into four ideological categories: anarchist-communist, anarcho-syndicalist, anarchist-individualist, and just plain anarchist. Sacco and Vanzetti fell into the anarchist-communist camp. The principal leader, or spokesman, for this group was Luigi Galiani.
Galiani was born in Vercelli, Italy, August 12, 1861. He became interested in anarchism in his teens. While a law student at Turin, he became a very outspoken militant. For his activities, he found himself exiled to France. In France, he was exiled for organizing May Day demonstrations. From France, he moved to Switzerland, where he was again exiled for honoring the Haymarket martyrs. He returned to Italy, where he was arrested for conspiracy charges. He spent over 5 years in prison on the island of Pantelleria, where he escaped in 1900. After his escape, Galiani made his way to America via Egypt through London. Upon his arrival in America, Galiani jumped into labor activism by involving himself in the Patterson silk workers' strike. He would survive a gunshot wound to the face during a strike demonstration.
On June 6th of 1903, Galiani would start the Cronaca Subversiva, or Subversive Chronicle, an Italian anarchist newspaper which would become very influential. Paul Averick, in his book Sacco and Vanzetti, The Anarchist Background, says, "The Cronaca Subversiva was one of the most important and aptly edited periodicals in the history of the anarchist movement."
On May 18, 1917, Congress passed a military conscription act which required all males between 21 and 30 to register, including immigrants. Failure to register carried a penalty of a year in jail. Galiani denounced the war and the draft in the Subversiva, then advised anarchists to go elsewhere for the duration of the war.
It was at a meeting held in Boston by Galianistas that Nicola Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti would meet for the first time. At this meeting, it was decided that they would depart for Monterrey, Mexico. It was there that about 60 followers of Galiani would start a cooperative community. Within 6 months, the community would break up. Sacco, because of family obligations, would be the first to return under the alias Nicola Mascomatelli. After a period of hard times for him and his family, Sacco would gain employment again as a skilled edge trimmer at the 3K shoe factory, where he would be employed until the time of his arrest.
Vanzetti adopted the alias Bartolomeo Negrini when he left Mexico. He traveled to Youngstown, Ohio, where he got work in a steel mill and stayed there for almost a year, then moved back to Plymouth. In the spring of 1919, he bought a fish cart with knives and scales, along with a bell, and became a fish peddler. He did not make a lot of money, but he was self-sufficient and worked on his own, which allowed him time for his activities as a very active anarchist.
country, from shore to shining shore, and it really made me wonder at the things I heard and saw. I saw the weary farmer plowing sod and loam, and I've heard the auction hammer just a knocking down his home. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the walls are stuffed with silver. Let the farmer sweat it for. I've seen the seamen standing idly by the shore, and I've heard the bosses saying, got no work for you no more. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the walls are stuffed with silver that the seamen sweated for. I've seen the weary miner scrubbing coal dust from his back, and I've heard his children crying, got no coal to heat the shack. But the banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the mine has sweated for. I've seen the weary old folk without nickel left to give, and the hovels that they exist in are not fit for rats to live. But the banks are made of marble, with the guard at every door, and the vaults are stuffed with silver that the old folks sweated for. I've seen our people working throughout this mighty land, and I've prayed we'd get together and together make a stand. Then we own those banks of marble, with the guard at every door, and we share those vaults of silver that we all have sweated for.
In exploring the lives and frame-up of Sacco and Vanzetti, we must emphasize the point that Sacco and Vanzetti were followers of Luigi Galiani, who was probably the most radical of all the established leadership of anarchists. His paper, The Cornacchia Sovversiva, was read the world over. He openly advocated acts of violence against the capitalist system and published a very controversial 46-page bomb-making manual called La Salute in Voi, Health is in You. The manual called for vengeance against tyrants and oppressors.
Followers of Galiani were suspected of many bombings throughout the U.S. Many students and apologists on the left will declare that the FBI or its predecessor, the Bureau of Investigation, was responsible for many of these bombings. And while it is undoubtedly true that BOI and FBI agent provocateurs were responsible for some bombings, it is also true that Galianistas were responsible for many bombings and attempted bombings. According to Paul Avrick in Sacco and Vanzetti, The Anarchist Background, Galiani implicated himself in the 1916 Preparedness Day bombing during deportation hearings in 1918. Two labor activists, Warren Billings, and Fred Mooney were framed up for that bombing and both spent many years in jail as a result.
Averick also suspects that Galleanistas were responsible for the mailing of 30 bomb-bearing packages in April of 1919 to judges, politicians, the Attorney General, and several well-known robber barons. Only a few of these bombs went off. Most were intercepted by postmasters and law enforcement agencies.
2 months after the failed mail bomb attempts on June 2nd of 1919, 7 bombs exploded almost simultaneously within an hour of midnight in New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Paterson, and Washington, D.C. At the site of each bombing were copies of a leaflet bearing the title Plain Words, with a full-page statement declaring class war. The leaflet was full of spelling and grammatical errors. What follows is a few excerpts from the leaflet.
A time has come when the social question's solution can be delayed no longer. Class war is on and cannot cease but with complete victory for the international proletariat. There will be bloodshed. We will not budge. There will have to be murder. We will kill because it is necessary. There will have to be destruction. We will destroy to rid the world of your tyrannical institutions. We are ready to do anything and everything to suppress the capitalist class, just as you are doing anything and everything to suppress the proletariat class.
The leaflets were signed The Anarchist Fighters.
Of all these bombings, the one that created the greatest sensation was the bomb that went off at the home of Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer. The man delivering the bomb was himself blown up. No one else was injured. Who was the bomber? It seems that several historians agree that the bomber was Carlo Valdinocchi, a follower and friend of Galliani, and a member of the group that went to Mexico with Sacco and Vanzetti. Valdinocchi was a young man of 24 and somewhat of a hero to the Italian anarchists because of his ability to elude the BOI and the police, who were after him for a Youngstown bombing conspiracy, as well as for his involvement with publishing the Cuernaca Sovversia.
Attorney General Palmer used the bombings as an excuse to increase the BOI budget. They also used the bombings to create a tidal wave of fear and anger throughout the U.S. against immigrants and radicals. They declared the bombings to be a nationwide organized conspiracy to overthrow the American government. The newspapers took up the cry of Red Menace and demanded electric chair treatments for aliens and radicals. Political demagogues demanded action in the form of a hangman's noose.
It was in this atmosphere that Attorney General Palmer launched a series of nationwide roundups of suspected alien radicals in November of 1919. Assisted by local police and right-wing pro-capitalist support groups such as the American Protective League, the National Security League, and the American Defense Society, they swooped down on meeting halls, private homes, destroyed printing presses, and confiscated papers. They illegally detained thousands of immigrants and suspected radicals. Many were beaten and tortured in effort to extract information. As a result of those arrests, over 800 people would be deported within a year, including well-known anarchists Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman.
On January 2, 1920, Palmer launched what we know today as the Red Raids, or the Palmer Red Raids. Simultaneously, in 70 cities across the U.S., over 10,000 people were arrested in one night for nothing more than belonging to a union or having a family member in a union. It was a repeat of the November raids, complete with beatings and torture. Only this time, American-born radicals were included in the milieu. Many were held for days and weeks incommunicado.
Another important event that preceded the arrest of Sacco and Vanzetti was the arrest of Andrea Salcedo in March of 1920. Salcedo was a friend and follower of Galliani, as well as a good friend and associate of Sacco and Vanzetti. Upon Salcedo's arrest, he was beaten and tortured severely for several days, after which he broke down and confessed to his role in the bombings, as well as naming names of comrades. For the next 2 months, he would be held incommunicado. In April, Salcedo managed to smuggle out a couple of letters to Vanzetti asking for support and money to obtain a new lawyer. Vanzetti and his comrades decided to dispose of their anarchist literature, not knowing how much Salcedo may have disclosed. because under the Immigration Act of 1918, anarchist literature was cause for deportation proceedings.
On May 2, 1920, the body of Andrea Salcedo was discovered crushed on the sidewalk 14 stories below the room in which he was held by the Justice Department's Bureau of Investigation. The Justice Department claimed Salcedo committed suicide. Sacco, Vanzetti, and many of Salcedo's friends and family felt he was thrown from the 14th floor by BOI agents.
Even if Salcedo did jump, as the BOI claimed, it does not absolve the U.S. Department of Injustice of the responsibility. Salcedo was beaten and tortured into confessing against his comrades and family whom he had devoted his life to. This, no doubt, added to the torture he had already been subjected to. He had unwillingly broken the anarchist code by informing on his comrades. If Salcedo did jump, he was driven to do so by the Justice Department, and murder by forced suicide is still murder. So whether Salcedo jumped or not is irrelevant.
On May 5, 1920, after a failed attempt to secure an automobile into which Sacco and Vanzetti would load up and dispose of incriminating anarchist literature, they boarded a streetcar for Brockton. As they entered town, a policeman got on and placed them under arrest for being suspicious characters.
Because of the many arrests of anarchists and radical comrades preceding their arrests, and because of the arrest and murder of Salcedo, Sacco and Vanzetti had expected to be arrested any day and be subjected to deportation hearings. Both, in fact, had made plans to return to Italy. Sacco even had a passport prepared, so when arrested, they thought they were being held for deportation.
When arrested, Sacco had in his possession a .32 caliber Colt semi-automatic. Vanzetti had in his possession a .38 caliber 5-shot revolver and several shotgun shells. The most damning possession on them was a leaflet announcing an anarchist rally featuring Vanzetti as a speaker.
Prior to their arrest, South Braintree Police Chief Michael Stewart had a strong suspicion that the robbery at the Slater and Morrell Shoe Company and the attempted robbery in Bridgewater were the actions of anarchists. His suspicions were based on pure fantasy. But nonetheless, when he heard about two suspicious Italians and well-known anarchists who were armed, he went to Brockton to question them.
During his interrogation, Stewart asked questions about citizenship, were they communists or anarchists, and if they believed in overthrowing the government, what anarchist literature they subscribed to. The next day, District Attorney Frederick Kotzman gave a repeat performance, but no questions about any robberies or murder. During their interview, Sacco and Vanzetti gave false or evasive answers. They lied about political beliefs, their reasons for carrying pistols, and about their reason for visiting West Bridgewater.
Their evasive and suspicious behavior became the basis for a legal concept known as consciousness of guilt. At their murder trial in Dedham, this consciousness of guilt constituted the strongest evidence against them. Consciousness of guilt was emphasized by the prosecutor Katzman to the jury over and over and was used by Judge Thayer as an excuse to deny defense motion for a new trial.
Consciousness of guilt is also why this program spent a good deal of time exploring the lives, beliefs, actions, and the political atmosphere surrounding the time of arrest. Paul Avrick, author of many books on anarchism and anarchist personalities, says, Sacco and Vanzetti had indeed displayed consciousness of guilt, and this undoubtedly figured in their conviction. Of what guilt were they conscious? According to the prosecution, their lies betrayed their involvement in the South Braintree holdup. Yet this is not necessarily the case. There is another, more plausible explanation, namely, that the men thought that they were arrested for radical activities, and therefore lied to protect their friends as well as to avoid criminal prosecution. Avrick goes on to conclude that the guilt of which they were conscious was that of anarchism, not of robbery and murder.
Before the South Braintree murder-robbery case was to be tried, Vanzetti was tried for the attempted robbery in Bridgewater. Sacco had an airtight alibi, being clocked in at work. Vanzetti had dozens of witnesses who swore he was peddling fish on the day of the robbery, the 24th of December, a day the Italian community traditionally ate eels, which Vanzetti sold. Despite conflicting witness testimony and the lack of any real evidence, Vanzetti was convicted of assault with intent to do murder. But because the jury tampered with evidence, Judge Webster Thayer nullified the conviction and imposed the lesser conviction of assault with intent to commit robbery. He did this to prevent the defense from having legal grounds for a new trial. After convicting Vanzetti of the lesser charge, he imposed the longest ever sentence for that particular crime on a first-time offender in the state's history, 12 to 15 years. The typical sentence for that crime was 6 months to 3 years.
Sacco and Vanzetti were indicted for the murder of the two guards, Alessandro Berardelli and Frederick Parmenter, on September 10th of 1920. 3 months later, in December, a court interpreter, Angelino De Falco, approached the defense committee of Sacco and Vanzetti with a backdoor deal. For $40,000, she'd arranged to fix the jury if they would discharge their present counsel and hire Francis Squires and Percy Katzman, brother of District Attorney Frederick Katzman. As part of the deal, Brother Frederick would resign. Lead Attorney Fred Moore, fearing a setup, had Mrs. DeFalco arrested for soliciting legal business. She was subsequently acquitted.
Mrs. DeFalco and her cohorts, which included judges and prosecutors, seems to have been involved with several of these backdoor deals and jury tampering. She was later convicted for bribery. William Young and David E. Kaiser, in their book, Postmortem, New Evidence in the Case of Sacco and Vanzetti, say that it is doubtful that Mrs. DeFalco could have made good on all her grandiose promises, but her offer suggests a good possibility of disposing of the case without a trial. Moore's decision to go public put an abrupt end to any such possibility. The prosecution began searching for new evidence immediately after Mrs. DeFalco's arrest.
Katzman revisited all the evidence and statements of witnesses. In re-interviewing many of the witnesses, Katzman used pressure, manipulation, and intimidation to get witnesses to change their original statements so that they would identify Sacco and Vanzetti. Several workers from the Morrill Shoe Factory, who refused to identify them on the witness stand, found themselves fired upon returning to work.
From their book Postmortem, Kaiser and Young conclude, "Eyewitness testimony is notoriously fallible. Physical and circumstantial evidence are far more important. Yet the eyewitness testimony to the crime remains significant. Over 75% of those having opportunity to view the bandits before, during, or immediately after the crime denied having seen Sacco and Vanzetti. Of the 11 prosecution witnesses who did identify them, the testimony of 8 of them, including every single eyewitness to the crime or escape, was vitally impeached."
The arresting officer, Michael Connolly, who never mentioned any suspicious movements by Sacco and Vanzetti during the arrest in his police report, nor later to the press, testified at the trial that they made a move towards their guns. This line of testimony was to reinforce the state's all-important concept of consciousness of guilt.
The main physical evidence against Sacco and Vanzetti were the pistols found on them during their arrest, the .32 caliber bullets taken from Berardelli's body, and the shell casings found at the scene of the crime. The prosecution claimed the .38 caliber Harrington and Richardson found on Vanzetti was taken from the body of Berardelli during the robbery. This was the only physical evidence to connect Vanzetti to the robbery.
In the book Postmortem, New Evidence in the Case of Sacco and Vanzetti, William Young and David Kaiser maintain that documents newly released from state police files show that Vanzetti's revolver was very definitely not Berardelli's. What is significant is that they show that the prosecution sent Vanzetti to the electric chair on evidence that they knew to be false. What has come out in these files is that the prosecution had the serial number of the pistol owned by Berardelli and knew that it did not match Vanzetti's pistol. Be it also noted that the pistol that Berardelli owned was a .32 caliber and the one that Vanzetti owned was a .38 caliber. A memo to this effect was discovered in Chief of Police Michael Stewart's files in 1977.
As to the evidence of the bullets and the shell casings against Sacco, according to the officers of Postmortem, originally only 3 shell casings were discovered. A 4th, matching Sacco's, was later placed into evidence. They also maintained that the death bullet, called bullet number 3, was switched to a bullet fired from Sacco's .32 caliber semi-automatic Colt, which had a left twist to the barrel grooves. All the other bullets had a right twist to the barrel grooves, When the bullets were first taken from Berardelli's body, the investigating officer and the medical examiner both made notes that all the bullets were the exact same.
In postmortem, Young and Kaiser say, "The vast documentation now available has enabled us to tell the story of the preparation of the prosecution's case in almost all its aspects. The revelations of the police files, the grand jury proceedings, and the prosecution's notebooks show that virtually every piece of evidence against the two men ultimately rested on falsehoods and fabrications."
Despite the fabrications, despite the falsehoods, Sacco and Vanzetti were found guilty of murder on July 14th, 1921. After a jury foreman announced the verdict, Sacco's voice rang out loudly.
"Sono innocente. They kill an innocent man. Don't forget, two innocent men they kill."
As it would turn out, the conviction of Sacco and Vanzetti was only the beginning of a seven-year-long ordeal of appeals, denials, hunger strikes, force feeding, and power plays by government officials. A worldwide support movement would grow, which would include Albert Einstein and H.G. Wells, to name but a very few. Rallies and protests would be held in major cities all over the world. Thousands would be arrested. Also, several bombings would take place, targeting the jury members, the governor, and later, Judge Thayer himself would be a target.
On November 18, 1925, Nicola Sacco was handed a magazine by a trustee who implored him to open it. Inside was a note that said, "I hereby confess to being in the South Braintree Shoe Company crime, and Sacco and Vanzetti was not in said crime." The note was signed Celestino Medeiros. Sacco immediately broke down and cried.
Medeiros was on death row a few cells down from Sacco and Vanzetti. He was convicted of killing a cashier in a bank robbery. He had attempted to notify police of his part in the robbery murder, but they refused to listen.
Medeiros was part of an organized crime gang known as the Morelli Gang, run by brothers Frank and Joe, who made their living largely by robbing freight cars near Providence. In one particular robbery, they were indicted for robbing freight from Rice and Hutchins Shoe Company. Interestingly enough, the slain payroll guard, Berardelli, was assigned to investigate the Rice and Hutchins freight robberies. It is also interesting to note that Berardelli was fired from his former job with the Watts Detective Agency for stealing and dishonesty.
On that fateful day in April 15th, 1920, Berardelli broke his usual routine and left work earlier than he normally did. He also made unusual comments to his wife about hoping everything worked out today. These connections leave much to speculate about. Did Berardelli set up the robbery with the Morelli brothers? If so, did the Morelli gang double-cross Berardelli to keep his share of the money and to keep from being identified if Berardelli was discovered? Berardelli's part in this beyond his death can only be speculated on, but the part that the Morelli gang played in the robbery murder at the Slater Morrell Shoe Company is also confirmed in a book, My Life in the Mafia, by Mafia informant Vincent Teresa. He says that Frank Morelli confessed to him that the gang pulled the robbery and murdered the guards. He quotes Morelli as saying, "Vinny, those two suckers took it on the chin for us. That shows you how much justice there really is."
Despite Medeiros' confession and his broad inside knowledge of the robbery, the powers that be had determined that Sacco and Vanzetti must die. On April 5th of 1927, the Supreme Court denied against a motion for a new trial based on new evidence. Immediately, District Attorney Wilbur called for an imposition of sentence, and thereby a special session was called for Saturday, April 9th.
In his sentencing, Nicola Sacco looked Judge Webster Thayer defiantly in the eye and said,
"I am not an orator. It is not very familiar with me, the English language. I know the sentence will be between classes, the oppressed class and the rich class, and there will always be a collision between one and the other. You persecute the people, tyrannize over them, and kill them. That's why I am here on this bench today, for having been a member of the oppressed class. Well, you are the oppressor. Judge Thayer knew all my life, and he know I never been guilty, not yesterday, not today, nor forever.
Vanzetti was next to speak, and what follows is merely excerpts from his speech.
What I say is that I am innocent, not only of the Braintree crime, but also of the Bridgewater crime. That I not only innocent of these two crimes, but all my life I have never stole and I have never killed and I have never spilled blood, but I have struggled all my life since I began to reason to eliminate crime from the earth. Everyone who knows these two arms knows very well that I did not need to go in between the streets and kill a man to take money. I can live with my two arms and live well. You see, it is 7 years that we are in jail. What we have suffered these 7 years, no human tongue can say. And yet, you see me before you, not trembling. You see me looking at you in your eyes, straight, not blushing, not changing color, not ashamed in fear. I would not wish to a dog, nor to a snake, to the most low and misfortunate creature on earth. I would not wish to any of them what I have had to suffer for things that I am not guilty of. I am suffering because I am a radical. And indeed, I am a radical. I have suffered because I am Italian. And indeed, I am an Italian. I have suffered more for my family and for my beloved than for myself. But if I could be reborn again, two other times, I would live again to do what I have done already. If it had not been for this thing, I might have lived out my life talking at street corners to scorning men. I might die unmarked, unknown, a failure. Now we are not a failure. This is our career and our triumph. Never in our life could we hope to do such work for tolerance, for justice, for man's understanding of man. And now we do. My accident, our words, our lives, our pains, nothing. The taking of our lives, lives of good shoemaker and a poor fish peddler, all that last moment belongs to us. That agony is our triumph.
After Sackle and Vanzetti had their last say before the court, Judge Webster Thayer, who had been heard to say, "I'm going to get those bastards good and proper," and "Did you see what I did to those anarchist bastards?" pronounced death sentences on Niccolo Sacco and Bartholomew Vanzetti.
To give their state-sanctioned murder some semblance of justice, the good governor, Alvin T. Fuller, set up an impartial committee of Boston's most elite citizens to review the trial, known as the Lowell Committee, on June 1, 1927.
The Lowell Committee consisted of Harvard University President Abbott Lawrence Lowell, retired probate judge Robert Grant, and Samuel Stratton, the president of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. These three esteemed gentlemen reviewed all the evidence and testimony of the case. Their review was a whitewash and gave the governor the excuse he needed to proceed with the executions.
And so historians tell us that a little after midnight on August 22, 1927, Celestino Medeiros, Niccolo Sacco, and Bartolomeo Vanzetti were executed. Sacco's last words were a defiant,
"Long live anarchy. Farewell to my wife and friends. Farewell."
Vanzetti's last words,
"I am an innocent man."
Then softly, before the switch was thrown, he said,
"I now wish to forgive some people for what they are doing to me."
With tear-filled eyes, Warden Henry choked out the words, "Under the law, I now pronounce you dead, the sentence of the court having been carried out. The following epilogue was taken from the book The Passion of Sacco and Vanzetti by Howard Fast.
At that time, in the city of Boston, there was a club known as the Athenaeum, and to this club there belonged those whose names were connected with the city's past, with the long past days of Emerson and Thoreau. Such men as the president of the university, who sat in final judgment on Sacco and Vanzetti, were powerful influences in this club, a place into which no Jew or Negro had ever penetrated. On the morning after the execution, on August 23, 1927, a slip of paper was found to have been inserted in every magazine in the reading room of the club, and on each slip of paper were the following words:
"On this day, Niccolò Sacco and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, dreamers of the brotherhood of man who hoped it might be found in America, were done to a cruel death by the children of those who fled long ago to this land of hope and freedom."
That poured the finest wine. Who will remember the genteel words they spoke that named the lives of two good men a nuisance or a joke? And all who know these two good arms know I never had to rob or kill. I can live by my own two hands and live well. And all my life I have struggled to rid the earth of all such crime.
Do good.
The following books and articles provided the source material for this program: The Passion of Sacco and Vanzetti by Harold Fast, Postmortem: New Evidence in the Case of Sacco and Vanzetti by William Young and David E. Kaiser, Sacco and Vanzetti Murderers or Murders by Harold Blumenfeld, Tragedy in Denham by Francis Russell, Sacco and Vanzetti: The Anarchist Background by Paul Arvick, Crimes and Punishment Volume 3 by BPC Publishing, Time Magazine, July 5th to September 5th, 1927. The music of this program was Struggle Blues by Woody Guthrie and Cisco Houston, Banks of Marble sung by Fred Holstein, Two Good Arms by Holly Near and Ronnie Gilbert, Beloved Comrade, Holly Near and Ronnie Gilbert. This program was recorded in the studios of KZYX of Philo, California. The script was written by Gene Lawhorn. This program was produced by Gene Lawhorn and Judy Berry and engineered by Judy Berry. The voice of Sacco and Vanzetti was performed.